Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. You know, a lot of people find it heartbreaking to read about wildlife poaching in Africa. Elephant tusks and rhinoceros horns have become prized commodities. Harvesting them has become a lucrative and illegal enterprise. Our next guest, novelist Ridley Pearson, has become an outspoken anti-poaching advocate. His role as a best-selling author gives him a big platform from which to deliver this message, and it's part of the plot of his latest book, White Bone. Ridley Pearson joins me in studio.
Hey,
nice to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me in.
I don't know when you have time to sit down and talk with people like me because you write so many darn books. You've got more than 50 of them, did you say?
I do, yeah. No, I'm writing. I love what I do, and it's a... I think you have to keep moving or you fall by the wayside in this business. So,
well, I thoroughly enjoyed White Bone.
We
can't give too much away because you want to sell books and you want people to read them and enjoy them. But let's just point out that this is another John Ross and Grace Chu adventure.
John Knox and Grace Chu, who've been in three other books that I've written. And I actually wanted to explore their relationship because in previous books it's been quite professional, and yet it's funny as a writer because it sounds so snobby to say, hey, the characters write your book, but then in so many ways the characters write your book, and especially Grace Chu, I've become incredibly fond of and have felt her appreciation of Knox go a little bit beyond the professional, although she's never voiced it. And so in White Bone, I was looking for a vehicle to bring them closer together by pushing them apart.
I was just going to say, bringing them closer together was difficult because they're hardly ever together.
Exactly
in this
right.
This is more of a kind of a disappearing, missing persons kind of a novel than it is an anti-poaching document.
It is. Grace goes missing in the bush after discovering that some vaccination financing has gone astray. And actually, there was a big, I don't know if you saw it, but there was a big news piece about this about 8-10 days ago. It's always so fun for me when I do all this research and then it pops up into the news. But they had a million vaccinations out of 6 million disappear. It was either in Kenya or a nearby African nation. And, of course, those are just going on to the black market. And that's what happens at the start of White Bone. And Grace is trying to pursue this money. Who took this money? Why didn't we get the vaccinations to where they were supposed to be? What happened? And she goes missing.
Yeah. Well, let's leave it at that because it's a fun
book
to read.
Well, we can't leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave that part of it at that.
Well, the fun part of that, though, is that I am an Eagle Scout. And so I, in writing this novel, I felt it really important to go over there to Kenya and see firsthand what was going on. And I spent a little over 3 weeks there. I interviewed about 25, 26 people, and I traveled all over the country. And one of my travels took me to a lodge, the Solio Lodge near Nanyuki, which is featured in the book, and so is the lodge. The lodge, really, so much of the novel follows my experience when I was doing my research, which is true of how I write in general.
Well, interestingly, I think if I read correctly some of the notes about the book, that you really kind of changed your mind about a lot of things.
I did.
And had to rewrite the
book. I wrote
two
books, actually was my second White Bone. The first dealt with Knox's brother going missing in a very different way. And my editor and I wrote the whole book, probably five drafts of it. My editor and I got to the point that it was publishable. And I said, this just isn't the book I want to write. This isn't what I came to do. And I went to Kenya and got all this research under my belt, including going around a reserve with a guide named Ole, who's in the book. Mm-hmm. And I told Ole that I am an Eagle Scout, and I've done an awful lot of camping and hiking and survivalist kind of backcountry work. And, how would I hold up in the African bush? And he said very politely, "I'm sorry, sir, but you wouldn't make it a night." Uh-huh. And I said, "No, come on. I've done a lot of this. I would make it a night." And he said, "No, you wouldn't make it a night." And I said, "Well, I need to make it in my novel 4 to 5 days as, basically a white person who knows nothing about your culture. Mm-hmm. Educate me." And we spent the next 3 or 4 days digging up roots and slicing bark on trees. And he basically gave me a thumbnail sketch of how a white person might be able to make it 4 or 5 nights in the bush.
And we'll just point out, this is the dilemma in which Grace Chu finds
exactly.
herself.
Exactly. So that's
it's
her
survival.
Whole thread. All yeah. of what you read in there is what Ole taught me.
You know, Ridley, the fact that you spent that time in Kenya is interesting to me, because the last time we spoke, that your previous novel had dealt with Istanbul.
Yes.
And you told me that you hadn't been there.
Yeah, for the first time. I couldn't get there. I booked 2 different trips. And the first time an American was killed days before I was supposed to leave, and the second there were riots. And so both times I had to cancel my trip.
In a sense, it's a good place not to get to these days. There's been
a lot of
problems.
Yeah, it turns out. But it would have been perfect then. It's just I hit some bad patches.
But I read that book, and I was impressed in reading it with the detail. I mean, you had lot of very obvious, accurate detail.
I did
about
a ton of reading and calling and Googling and all of that, but it's much better to get there on the ground and see it firsthand. For instance, when I traveled to Kenya in May of 2014, and I wasn't there 4 or 5 days, and they had their second big terrorist bombing. It was in a marketplace maybe 3 miles from where I was staying. 12 people were killed, 70 were injured, and there I was writing about poaching, financing terrorism, mm-hmm. these very same terrorists. And so for me, it was incredibly visceral. My security had to be upped. They wouldn't let me into some places that I had planned to go. So again, like my Turkey experience, I was mm-hmm. sort of blocked from some of the areas I wanted to see. But it brought home what this is all about. And you see the ways that a society like Kenya sort of has 3 layers of society, and you could see the 3 layers respond to that bombing very, very differently.
Pretty corrupt society, according to what we read, and certainly in your book.
Yeah, that's what I found. But you know, we put corrupt in sort of italics and bold, and I think if you've traveled a lot to third world countries, including Mexico, it's. Corrupt takes on a different level in these countries. You might be able to pay your way out of a traffic violation. You might, let somebody in on a phone number or a messaging number on a phone or something for a favor. And it goes all the way up to where people skim and take millions of dollars. But it is a society that revolves around barter. You know, it isn't all done with cash. So if I need something from you, you do me a favor, I do this guy a favor, and that's the way the whole thing works.
You did a lot of interviews, as you suggested.
I did, yeah.
And again, from what I've read beyond and outside of the book, that a lot of the people that you talked to were not very honest with you.
It shocked me, Don. I should be less gullible than I am, since I've interviewed police and government people for a career that spans 30 years now. But I met with our State Department a few times. I met with many, many conservationists. And it just turns out that everybody has a degree of skin in the game that they're unwilling to be fully honest about. It really is honesty. I was trying to look for a more gentle word, but it really is honest. So I got to the very last interview, and I interviewed a brilliant lawyer who is an activist, basically battling the Kenyan government the whole time to get more attention to poaching and more resources to poaching. And she and I were supposed to have a 20-minute meeting. It went on for about 3 hours. And near the end, I went through my notebook. And I listed with whom I'd spoken and what they had given me. And she would say, oh, well, that's not entirely true. Mm-hmm. And I would say something else, and she'd say, oh, well, that's just not true at all. And I realized that even the people who had hosted me, who are phenomenal guides, had hid the truth from me. They hadn't lied to me, but they had hid the truth from me. I was at that lodge in Solio, and I'm there to research poaching, and it's a full moon. And I go out the next day with Ole, and we're noodling around in the safari truck. And there was a tree filled with vultures. And I said, let's go over near those vultures. That should indicate some kind of kill. And he said, no, that's a roosting tree. No need to. And we drove on. Well, there was a dead rhinoceros under the tree. It had been poached the night before. I was the only guest in the lodge, and they all hid it from me for the next 3 days.
How much of that is going on still today?
Poaching?
Poaching, yeah.
We lose 100 elephants a day. We lose 30,000 a year.
Just in Kenya?
In Africa.
In Africa, okay.
Yeah. There are there were 1.2 million in 1979 wild elephants in Africa. And the reason I wrote White Bone was because I had heard that my grandchildren wouldn't see an elephant in the wild in Africa. And I said, that can't be, and started looking into it. And sure enough, now there are less than 400,000 left. And we're losing 30,000 a year. Do the math. I mean, we got 8-9 years.
But they have people over there whose specific job is to prevent this from happening. Is this where the corruption?
There are 140 NGOs, non-government organizations, trying to protect the elephants, and we're still losing 30,000 a year.
So, what conclusion do we draw from that?
What we draw from that, and what I drew from my work on the novel, is that there are certainly a dozen of those 140 that are doing a phenomenal job. One of the crying shames is there are some terrific agencies that aggregate their efforts. But they informed me that of those 140, less than 100 cooperate with each other because they try to protect their own donations. They try to protect their own little piece of ground. And it's just such a sad state of affairs when ego and fear motivate people who are trying to help. They're doing good work, but they won't come together and pull together as this united 100 NGO front to stop this. So in doing my research, I discovered things like Big Life, an organization actually started by Nick Brandt, a phenomenal wildlife photographer from the USA. They have expanded and grown and grown, and they're policing now about 4 million acres in southern Kenya. And they've stopped poaching there. They've just outright stopped it. But they stopped it by having 250 uniformed guards and guides. They have jeeps. They have digital radios so no one can listen in where they are. They work with the communities, and they have started the Kenyan Olympics for the young Maasai, who to gain manhood would typically go out and kill one of the big five, a lion, an elephant, and now they compete for gold medals in the Maasai Olympics, and they don't need to go out and kill this. And it's been a brilliant solution. So Nick Brandt and that group have done such a good job that, you know, what I advocate at the end of the book is, even if it's $10, send $10 to these people. You wouldn't believe what $10 can do in Africa. And it's like sending $1,000.
I should point out that you're also donating 20% of your royalties to this cause.
And maybe more. I mean, I realized that at the end of all this that dollars are, in fact, what will save the elephant and not much else.
Obviously, this is a very lucrative trade. People listening now might not realize the extent of it. And where is this stuff going?
Yeah, so it's going, rhino horn is going to South Vietnam and that part of Asia. And that's because a South Vietnamese government minister in, I think it was 2007, went on national TV and said that ground up rhino horn had cured his cancer. And the environmentalists had taken 20 to 30 years to get the rhino population back, and it was finally back right then. And within days, there were people in ATVs with automatic weapons gunning down rhinos and grinding up their horn and sending it to South Vietnam. So, I mean, South Africa lost 1,000 rhinos last year. The depredation on rhinos is unbelievable. And elephant tusk, as we've seen this massive rise in the affluence of the Chinese middle class, and I lived in China for a year, you see Lexuses and Porsches and incredible vehicles, and they're paying twice the price we would pay because there's 100% tax on them. They're carrying legitimate, you know, it's so funny in China because the Caucasians come in and buy the knockoffs, mm-hmm. and the legitimate nationalists buy, you know, Gucci that's and Versace and everything that's legit from. So they're paying $6,000 for their bags, and the Americans are paying $35 for their bags. But this affluent swell has left a hunger for carved ivory because it's the status symbol. It used to be, you know, $30,000, $40,000 for a piece. Now it's upward of $300,000, $400,000 for a piece, maybe $1 million, $2 million. And you put that on your mantle and it says, look who arrived, man. I've got carved ivory.
You know, it's clear you're pretty passionate about this, this problem.
I like elephants.
Yeah, don't we all?
Yeah, well, go see them in the wild because you just, you get this, I mean, literally when they walk by you, you get a pounding in your chest. Mm-hmm. But there's just something so iconically African about an elephant. How can we conceive of a world where man has allowed the elephant to vanish from Africa? That absolutely appalls me. It's not that there's a disease or something. We're killing these things.
You know, I saw something on television, one of the channels not too awfully long ago, that really struck me about elephants. And it was scenes of elephants mourning just as human beings do.
Three years later, yeah. An elephant can come across one of these poached bone piles, yeah. and it weeps. Tears come from its eyes. It has full memory of who that was, what role they had in their little society. They're all matron societies. Mm. And as the poachers go out and kill the big mother cows and saw off with chainsaws their tusks, they leave a society without a leader. And the societies break up and scatter, and then they're poached. So, I mean, the whole thing, it's just so cataclysmic. Is what it is.
One of the characters, if I can put it that way, in your book is an elephant with partial tusks. But one of the things that struck me about this particular elephant was this big thing it had around its neck, which played a key role in the book. But it was a GPS system,
right,
which the rangers are using to keep track of these things.
They are. They try to collar one or two in every one of these pods. They're like little mini herds, and they track these. And when I visited Big Life, you sit down in their communications room, and they have their screens up and their laptops open, and you can see with the location of all those GPS collars. And they can. What's really fascinating is they can filter you through 24 hours, 48 hours, a week, a month, a year, and you can see where this elephant has gone for that period of time. And the patterns that the elephants develop over chasing water holes.
And so when they see that this movement has stopped and it stays in one spot,
sadly,
that is the tip off that something's going on.
Yeah. What they hope, of course, is it's a dead battery or the elephant has figured out a way to get it off. And they do. But they also know it could be that the elephant's been killed. And so they immediately dispatch their rangers out there. They typically fly.
How big are these collars? I got the impression from the book that they're pretty substantial.
Well, they are pretty substantial. I mean, you can imagine the size of an elephant.
You don't have to imagine it.
Yeah, you can't put your or my belt around an elephant neck. And, you know, I thought they, with miniaturization and everything, but of course, elephants knock trees over, Don. Yeah. I mean, to scratch their heads. You see all these trees all over the place that were down. And I said, is there flooding here or wind? What's with all the trees? And my guy said, no, sir, those are the elephants. They scratch their heads and they knock the whole tree over. These things are so powerful. Yeah. Well, you can imagine what the box that holds the GPS has to endure. So they have incredibly strong, webbing around the neck. And then they have these boxes they build around the GPS to try to protect them so they don't.
Yeah, I got the impression that the box was more like about the size of a cinder block.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's like a picnic basket or something, yeah.
Yeah. I'm reminded that there was a story not too long ago about the burning of a number of, of a lot of ivory to send a message to the poachers. But there's a sense that this could backfire in that it might create a greater demand for the tusks.
Yes, I think that's something they weigh, but I am happy to announce that my contact at the State Department wrote me this summer, a terrific guy, and in Africa, and they had had the biggest burn, ivory burn ever. They had burned 12 pyres of ivory, millions of dollars worth of ivory. Again, trying to make enough noise that we might pay attention. They've had other burns, and China has even done some burns, trying to appear on an international thing that, oh, we won't condone this. But, of course, then you walk into a store in Shanghai and it's for sale. So, but this particular burn that happened in April, they went after a big mass media, social media blast to see if they couldn't finally reach enough people. And the numbers that came back were 1.3 billion tweets. So finally that burn worked.
Is there any concern on your part that this does create a greater demand?
No, I mean, I think the demand can't be met as it is. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is that Kenya and all these African countries, like we would store gold, they've been storing ivory for years and years. So they have vaults and vaults and vaults. In fact, it centers into the plot of White Bone. But I think it's actually good that they empty those vaults to a degree and say, look, we're willing to give up our wealth to show you the importance of stopping this crazy thing that is happening.
Is the poaching problem more pronounced in Africa with rhinos and elephants than it is in other parts of the world? Asia, for instance, with tigers and other wildlife that are precious to some people for whatever reason?
Well, there's certainly, I mean, I know the my neighbor in Idaho is one of the leading authorities on the Siberian tiger, and they're under attack, too, for their pelts and whatnot. What I didn't find out is if there's been any raid on the Indian elephants. Certainly they're closer to China, so I've got to think there has been. But it's just such a huge deal in Africa and it all started with charcoal. This whole problem started with the Somalis were getting their funding that was affording them to pirate our oil vessels through the sale of charcoal. So internationally, we shut down the market for charcoal, and then they didn't have a way to raise money, and they realized, oh, we can just shoot elephants. Mm. So by trying to do a good thing, we did a bad thing, and the elephants are now under attack.
So Ridley Pearson, where do we go from here? We've got about a minute left to talk. You're donating some of your money. If there's a movie sale, and I hope there is.
Yeah, if there's a movie sale, see, it would mean a big input of cash to you. I think that you go online and you look at Big Life and you look at other organizations. I've mentioned four or five at the end of White Bone, but it's up to every individual. But I really mean it. If it's kind of like donating to a political party. If you can donate $5 or $10, it would mean so much to the elephants.
Right. And it's important to us because when they're gone,
they're gone.
They're gone.
Yeah.
Let me point out, you'll be talking more about this on the 23rd, I guess it is. That's the date that I have for your appearance at the St. Louis County Library.
Yes, can't
7
wait.
O'clock at night. You'll be talking about White Bone.
At Library Headquarters. You bet.
On Lindbergh and some of the things we've been talking about. Ridley Pearson, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Go back to work now. You've got more books to write. Add to those 50. Thank you again. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.